So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas. And having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. That's the story. That's the story as it reads in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 15, verse 15, which we read just now as part of our scripture reading. That's the story that we know, yes. But there's so much about that story that we don't know, and that's not actually the moment of the story that I want to focus on this morning, at least to begin with. Because this moment is almost, we might say, the end of the story. Almost. Now, not of Jesus' story. That's not what I'm saying. In the Gospel of Mark, the story of Jesus goes on for another chapter and a half, approximately speaking. And in fact, in a sense, the story of Jesus is still going on today. And you're a part of it, and so am I. I'm talking about Pilate's story. In the Gospel of Mark, this verse is basically the end of Pilate's story. I mean, he does pop up one more time, so I guess the real end of his story is the Gospel of Mark in chapter 15, verses 44 and 45, after Jesus has died on the cross. Mark says, Pilate was surprised to hear that he should have already died, and summoning the centurion, he asked him whether he was already dead, and when he learned from the centurion that he was dead, he granted the corpse to Joseph. There, though, we might say Pilate is just a supporting character in the story of Joseph of Arimathea. The real Pontius Pilate story in the Gospel of Mark. The moment where the spotlight moves to shine, however briefly, on Pontius Pilate is here, verses 1 through 15, which we read as our scripture reading this morning. Now, I say Pontius Pilate, by the way, but if all we had to go on was the Gospel of Mark, we wouldn't know that he was called Pontius. Mark only ever calls him Pilate. Of the other gospel writers, in fact, Matthew and John only say Pilate. To know him as Pontius Pilate, if you're reading the Bible, what you have is one reference in the Gospel of Luke, one reference in Acts, and one in 1 Timothy. That's it. Which is interesting, in that the name Pilate is almost what we would think of as by way of a nickname. I mean, not exactly, but sort of. This next bit is for my history nerds. See, Roman names didn't work exactly like ours. Now, most of the Romans who were at all middle or upper class had three names, like most of us do. We say first name, middle name, last name. That's how we do it in the U.S. Or sometimes we'll say of the last name that it's your surname. But Romans had what they called praenomen, nomen, and cognomen, which together formed the tria nomia, the three names. And it's interesting because to them, the middle name, that was your actual nomen, which means simply name. It was what you call your nomen gentilicium, which means your family name, your clan name. To the Romans, that was who you were. You are a member of your clan, your family. That was the most important information about you. See, Rome was somewhat more of a collectivist culture than we are. Romans tended to think of themselves not simply or even primarily as individuals, but much more as members of the family from which they come. Some of you are from families like that, where the most important thing about you is your family name. So then your praenomen, literally your prename or forename, existed to tell people which one you were of that family. So for me, my nomen would be Ernesty, and my praenomen would be Jeffrey, so that people could know, oh, you're that Ernesty. But the problem was, for Roman men, there were only about 18 praenomens you could use and not sound like a weirdo. And not sounding like a weirdo was very important to the ancient Romans. But that meant if there were more than 18 men with the same nomen in the same family, you would inevitably start duplicating names. And how do you tell them apart? That's where the cognomen came in. Your cognomen, which is literally your with name, means like your extra name, was your way of individuating yourself. Often it would be given to you because of something you did. Occasionally, it would be like if your dad had a really cool cognomen, you might take his to indicate that you're his son. But basically, this meant your nomen comes to you because of what family you belong to, your prinomen is given to you by your parents, your cognomen you earn, or occasionally choose. Now, why does that any of that matter for our text today? Well, because we know a little bit about where Pontius Pilate fits into that. And it's maybe worth knowing to understand his character. Because Pontius is his nomen. There are actually several members of the Pontia clan in Roman history. Pontia is the name of the family, by the way, the Pontia clan. In Latin, a Pontus is a bridge. Pontia is the exact equivalent of our English surname, Bridges. It's just the Bridges family. That's who they were. In fact, the first Pontius mentioned in Roman history was in 387 BC. So understand, from Pontius Pilate's point of view, his family has 400 years of moderately distinguished history. He would think of himself as being in that stream. That's a lot to live up to, 400 years of history. That would be like me knowing about famous Ernesties back in Holland in the 1600s, which, by the way, I very do not. Now, most of the Pontia family that we hear about were either soldiers or politicians. That was the culture of that family. In fact, there was a famous Pontius, Pontius Aquila, whom some historians speculate may have been an ancestor of Pontius Pilate, maybe a grandfather or great-grandfather. But there was this famous Pontius, Pontius Aquila, who was among the tribunes and senators who assassinated Julius Caesar in 44 BC. In fact, had Pontius Pilate not gotten himself mixed up in the Jesus story, Pontius Aquila would probably have been the most famous or infamous Pontius in history, one of Caesar's assassins. So that tells you something about Pontius Pilate. There's a sense in which he's a typical member of his family. He's a soldier and a politician. And the thing is, we have no idea what his prinomen was. It's lost to history. It's not in the Bible, it's not in any of the historians who mention him, Josephus, Tacitus, Philo, it's just gone. Pilate, or as they would have said in Latin, Pilatus, is his cognomen. We don't know how he got it, we don't know the circumstances under which he acquired this cognomen, but we do know that probably what it has reference to is the Roman pilum, which was a kind of javelin, a short spear. Pilate means skilled with the pilum. It's like calling someone you know who's good with a gun, shooter. And the thing is, he apparently preferred to be known by his cognomen, Pilate. He wanted people to call him that. And it's hard not to hear a sort of implicit threat in that name, right? He's ready with the javelin. That's who he is, so look out. Look out for Pilatus, because he might stab you. So that's the man who finds himself in this situation, being called upon to decide the fate of one Jesus of Nazareth, first thing in the morning, on a day when he's already sort of overextended. Pilate is only here in Jerusalem this Friday morning, because it's the feast of Passover and unleavened bread, and the city is full of Passover pilgrims. Historians estimate that the population of Jerusalem temporarily swelled from 100,000 people to about 3 million during the Passover season. Pilate has come to town to keep order. His normal headquarters is not in Jerusalem. It's in the much more pleasant town of Caesarea Maritima on the coast. Beaches, sea breeze. In fact, I'll just show you this. This is an archaeological artifact found in the ruins of Caesarea Maritima. It's referred to as the Pilate Stone because it has on it a damaged inscription that can still be read that says, "To the divine Auguste, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, has dedicated this Tiberium." It would have been a sort of a shrine to the emperor Tiberius. And Pontius Pilate apparently built and dedicated this little shrine to his emperor there in Caesarea Maritima. So we're getting a picture of the man, sort of, from an ancient family that he would feel some responsibility not to dishonor, proud of his reputation, loyal to empire. And that combination of responsibility, pride, and loyalty is what's going to cause trouble for him in this situation. Because, as Roman governor of Judea, Pilate has basically three jobs. What are they? Job one, enforce the Lex Romana, the Roman law, according to Roman justice. Job two, keep the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Job three, collect Roman taxes and send them to Rome. Now, of the three, which one do you think is the most important? That's right, the taxes. If it comes down to a conflict between carrying out justice and keeping the peace, peace was more important to Rome than justice, but neither of them was as important as the one overarching rule, which was the taxes must flow. And we've been talking, this is now the eighth week, and this is the last sermon in this series. We've been talking about the way that Mark has been taking us through the last 2 days of the earthly life of Jesus. How, using the literary technique of interlacing, Mark has been showing us various characters and how they respond to what we've been describing as being broken and pressed. That's the title of the sermon series, Broken and Pressed. In Mark chapter 14, Mark centers his narrative around the image of Gethsemane. The whole story leads down into and then back out of Gethsemane, the Garden of Gethsemane. And we've been talking about how, for all these weeks now, about how that word Gethsemane is a Hebrew word that means oil press. The Garden of Gethsemane was an olive grove where olives were grown on olive trees and then harvested and processed for olive oil. And as we've been saying, what is it that has to happen to olives for them to give up their oil? They have to be put through the olive press. They have to be broken and pressed. And when they are broken and pressed, that's when the oil flows. And it's like Mark was very taken with this idea. This whole story is one big Gethsemane, one big oil press. Everybody in the oil press, like so many ripe olives, Mary of Bethany in the oil press, Jesus in the oil press, Judas in the oil press, Peter in the oil press, even the Jewish religious leaders are being put through the oil press. See, Mark understands that in these events, these people, metaphorically, are being broken and pressed. And what Mark is asking us to see is what flows out of these folk in the breaking and pressing. And I know that some of you who are here this morning are broken, pressed. Mark is asking us to consider, what flows out of broken, pressed people. And now before he ends this theme, it's like Mark wants to show us one final olive tossed into the olive press. It's Pilate's turn. And as soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him to Pilate. If you recall, 2 weeks ago, we talked about this, how if you read carefully, putting the information from all four Gospels together, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you realize that Jesus actually faced five different trials. This one here is trial number 3, which is essentially a show trial, a public affirmation of what had already been decided the night before in the house of Caiaphas, the high priest. But here's the thing. At that trial, the sentence had been death. Remember that? High priest tears his garments. What further witnesses do we need? You've heard his blasphemy. What's your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. That's the story. That's what the text says. But there's a problem. Under Roman law, only Rome has the right of capital punishment. They can condemn him to death, but they can't execute him. For that, they need the compliance of Rome, which is why they hand him over to Pilate. Now, this is interesting because Mark just says Pilate. No setup, no introduction, as though we're just supposed to know who he is. Because at the time that Mark was writing, his readers would have just known who he is. You read Matthew and Luke and John, writing later than Mark, they provide introductions. Pilate, the governor. Mark feels no need to elucidate, because in his mind, everybody should just know Pilate. But Mark says, and Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You've said so." Now, by the way, this is Mark condensing a lot of material, because this is the trial before Pilate, the whole trial, just that right there, one verse. If I were preaching from John, which I'm not, well, John has a much longer description of this trial, goes on for 11 verses. Mark is not interested in any of that, just this bit right here. But just this bit is worth seeing. Because do you remember in the trial in the house of Caiaphas, the verdict was guilty and the sentence was death, but what was the charge? Blasphemy. Jesus claims to be equal with God. Blasphemy. But now notice, that's not what Pilate thinks Jesus is being accused of, because Pilate wouldn't care about that. See, somewhere between trial 3 and trial 4, the charges have been changed from blasphemy, claiming to be equal with God, to treason, claiming to be a king. And now, an important thing to know about a Roman trial, particularly one out in the provinces like Judea, there was no jury and only one judge, the provincial governor. He listened to the charge, he heard witnesses, if any, and then he would give the accused an opportunity to defend himself, which is what Pilate is doing here. And I have to admit, I kind of love Jesus' answer because of how perfectly tailored it is to the situation. If you remember, when Jesus was asked to defend himself in the Jewish trial before Caiaphas, what he said to them was much more elaborate. Caiaphas asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Which, if you remember, is a claim to deity and what amounts to something like a threat. Because Jesus is saying to Caiaphas, "You think I'm on trial before you, but a day is coming when you will be on trial before me." But here, In this trial before Pilate, Jesus gives an answer that's way more ambiguous. In fact, it's a little difficult to translate. It's simple, but hard to translate. In Greek, it's sou leges, you say. But the thing is, there's no punctuation. Punctuation hadn't been invented yet. So Jesus might be saying, you say. In other words, he might be saying, so you say, or he might be saying, is that what you say? Or even, I don't know, what do you say? I mean, it's not quite, I know you are, but what am I? But it's neither an admission nor a denial as such. It's basically, what's the point of answering you? You're going to make up your own mind. Maybe. See, Jesus is looking right into Pilate's heart. And in essence, putting him on trial. Putting him in the olive press. Because it's Jesus pointing out what Pilate already knows. This situation is ridiculous and villainous and tragic. I know it. You know it. Which is why Mark says, and the chief priests accused him of many things. And Pilate asked him, have you no answer to make? See how many charges they are bringing against you. But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Who is it who's in the olive press at this moment? Now, we could do a little sidebar here and talk about the fact that Jesus is also, in a sense, still in the olive press. And he is from what flows out of him. Because what flows out of him? Silence. And I'm just going to say, in this kind of sidebar, Christians, sometimes, and I really wish my Christian people could get this, sometimes the best and most righteous response is no response. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Listen, you don't have to have an answer for everything. You don't always have to have something to say about everything in every situation. You know, from time to time, I hear my Christian people complain, and they're like, what am I even supposed to say to that? So-and-so said such-and-such, and what am I even supposed to say? Maybe nothing. I don't know, but sometimes maybe you say nothing. We're followers of Jesus, and you know what? Sometimes Jesus didn't always feel like he had to have something to say. Sometimes Jesus kept it shut. I don't know. Maybe be like Jesus. Here endeth the sidebar. But when earlier Jesus said, you say, that may also have been, in a sense, an invitation to Pilate. Are you the king of the Jews? You say. Hey, Pilate. That's on you to decide. Right at this moment, you're the one who has the power to make a decision. Heaven and earth are holding their breath, waiting to see what you will say about the kingship of Jesus. And Mark says, now at the feast, he used to release for them one prisoner for whom they asked. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. Now, this is actually pretty interesting, although we have some questions. Pilate thinks he sees a way out. Because there's a custom, apparently a local custom, that as a sign of the general frivolity of the season, the governor was accustomed to release a prisoner. Maybe Pilate can avoid having to make a decision this way. Now, we don't know what insurrection Mark is talking about exactly. Again, this is another example of Mark being so close to the events that he just expects his readers will know what he's talking about. There was an insurrection. What insurrection? We don't know. But this guy, Barabbas, definitely did some bad stuff during the insurrection. He killed somebody, or maybe some multiple somebodies. But he definitely has committed treason against Rome. Definitely treason. So what Pilate is basically doing is using Barabbas as a threat. Pilate says, okay, I'm going to put these two guys up here for release. Jesus, the King of the Jews, which you can have him back if you want. I'll let him go, even though there's maybe a claim to kingship. But if you don't pick Jesus, King of the Jews, it's going to be Barabbas, and nobody wants that. That's his plan. And nobody wants that except, Mark says, and the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them, and he answered them saying, do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews? For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. And that to me is fascinating, because Mark is not usually as psychological as this. Mark doesn't usually tell us about the inner lives of his characters. He usually shows us what they're thinking and feeling through their actions. But Mark has already told us more than he usually tells us when he told us that Pilate was amazed at the silence of Jesus. And now he tells us what Pilate perceives. And I wonder, how does Mark know all this? And it might be that you might think, he's just making a guess. Maybe so. Although if you are thoroughly supernaturalist about the inspiration of Scripture, which I think is worth being, you might say, God hath thus revealed it unto him. And maybe so. But I wonder. I wonder, because remember, we know some things about Mark. John Mark, he's called in the book of Acts. Marcus, by the way, in Latin. He's a Jewish boy with a Roman name, Marcus. And we know his family was a wealthy Jewish Jerusalem family. And it would not be out of the way for his family to have had dealings with Pontius Pilate. We know that Pilate had working relationships with many of the Jews in Jerusalem. We know, for instance, that Pilate had a decent working relationship with Caiaphas for about 5 years, the whole time Pilate's been governor. Which is maybe how Pilate could see what was going on here, because he knows Caiaphas. They've worked together closely. And he perceives that it's out of envy. But at any rate, Mark says Pilate could see that this was envy at work, not justice, envy. Which is maybe why Pilate's trying to wiggle out of this, because he has a working relationship with Caiaphas, and he knows what Caiaphas wants him to do. But he also knows it isn't right. And one of his jobs is justice. But the chief priests stirred up the crowds to have him release for them Barabbas instead. And Pilate again said to them, then what shall I do with the man you call the King of the Jews? And they cried out again, crucify him. Now this is a moment when I really hate that we have to read this in translation. We remember, of course, that Mark wrote this in first century Greek, and we read it in English translation. And Mark, in the first century Greek, is playing a little three-beat game with the words King of the Jews and the word say. Beat one is verse 2. Pilate asks, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "You say." Beat two is in verse 9. "And he answered them, saying," same word, "do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" Same words. Pilate, in other words, has just said. You catch that? Jesus said to him, when he said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus said to him, "You say." And now Pilate has just said, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" Pilate has made a choice. Beat three, though, right here in this verse, "What shall I do with the man you call," literally, "that you say is the king of the Jews?" See what Pilate's doing? Mark had said that Jesus said to Pilate, "You say whether I'm the king of the Jews or not." And a minute ago, Mark says Pilate was saying king of the Jews. But now the crowd has chosen Barabbas. The heat is on. Pilate tries to take it back and put it on them. "You say he's the king of the Jews." Jesus said to Pilate, "You say." And the moment things got a little hot, Pilate is passing the buck to the people. "You say." Now, he's not 100% sold yet on the idea of crucifixion. He has a little bit of what you might call integrity. A shard, a scrap, shred. Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." And that's it for Pilate. He's out. He's done. No further investigation, no more hesitations. Mark again gives us a glimpse of the inner workings of Pilate. So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowds, released for them Barabbas. And having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. And I just have to ask the question, is there anything worse that you can say about somebody than that that person did something that he or she knew wasn't right, wishing to satisfy the crowd? Pilate is in the oil press, and what flows out? Wishing to satisfy the crowd. And I need to say it that way, because we like to think of Pontius Pilate as one of history's great villains. We like to paint this picture of him as the man who condemned Jesus. And it would be very easy to accuse Pilate of some great sin, and fair enough. Is he guilty of injustice? Sure. Absolutely. But you know, we don't usually put ourselves in that category. I doubt any of us in the past week looked at our behavior and went, "That was really unjust of me. That was an injustice on my part." Cowardice? Oh, to be sure. But how many of us are willing to look into our own hearts and see the cowardice that lives there? Do you know what Pilate really did? What he really did was he refused to say. He chose not to make a choice. He refused to say who Jesus was because he wanted to satisfy the crowd. Oh, now that'll preach. Because is that you? Have you found yourself in the position where Jesus is king right up until the moment when it gets hard to have him as your king? Right up until that moment when you refuse to say who Jesus is to you because of the crowd? You know what happened to Pontius Pilate after this? You know what happened to Pontius Pilate after this? And neither do I. And here's why. We do know that about 7 years after these events, Pontius Pilate was recalled to Rome over an incident with some Samaritans. Pilate had a history of keeping the peace through violence. You read the historians, Josephus, Philo, Tacitus, you get the impression of a man who really, when it came right down to it, did not care nearly as much about justice as he did about peace. And so he was always kind of throwing soldiers at the problem. And he did that once too often and got recalled to Rome. And that's where the trail goes cold. We don't know what happened. We know he arrived in Rome right about the time that the Emperor Tiberius died and the new Emperor Caligula came to the throne. We know it was the habit of Roman emperors, whenever a new emperor came to the throne, they would clear the slate from stuff that was waiting on the old emperor. So it may be that Caligula was like, okay, I don't care. Pilate disappears from history at this point. Now there are stories. There are stories. Some sources like to say he committed suicide. That makes for a good story, doesn't it? That's a good, fair ending about Pilate, isn't it? He condemned Jesus, handed him over to the crowd, let them crucify him, and then he committed suicide. Of course. There's a whole other set of sources, Christian sources, that say ultimately he repented and became a Christian. In fact, there's one branch of the church that considers him a saint, tells stories about Saint Pilate. I don't know. I will tell you that there are some men of the Pontia family among the church leaders in the second century. We don't know if any of them were related to Pontius Pilate. We know they were there. Actually, most historians say that the worst possible thing happened to him. Nothing. That he lived out the rest of his days in obscurity. Nothing happened to him for the rest of his life. How terrible to meet Jesus, to have this amazing encounter, this history-making opportunity. Heaven and earth hold their breath while you ask the question, are you the King of the Jews? And the King of the Jews says back to you, why don't you decide? And then nothing. Because you decided not to decide. Jesus stands before you. The question hangs in the air. And heaven and earth hold their breath to hear what you will decide. Is he king? Is he the king of your life? What will you say? Pray with me. Father, my heart aches and my mind is in a tizzy when I consider Pontius Pilate. How wonderful and terrible to stand face to face with the King of Kings. and to be chosen for that moment to make that decision. Father, I know that in much smaller ways, each of us has a decision to make. What will we do with Jesus? Who will we decide he is? Father, help each of us today to make the decision that Jesus is our King. We ask it in his name and for his sake. Amen.